nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So today we're very happy to have Peter Gehring to come over here. And Peter is not new to Purdue. Actually grew up in the Indiana, the Goshen, as I know of. Then I know Peter for many, many years through the toxicology. Especially, I think I know Peter actually from your service in the study section, NAL. We used to call it LTOX 3, so they know your name, the early 1990s. At that time, I was trying to submit a grant. And also, Peter is very active in the toxicology. He was the president of metal specialty section, I think it's 1998 or 1999. And I was the president last year, so still knows your history, you know, when you do this history. Right now, Peter is the secretary of the Society of Toxicology, the one of the largest gathering of toxicology toxicologists worldwide. I think that Gary was the previous one. So today, we're very, very happy to have Peter to come over here. We just finished the 101 class called Health Science 101, teach to the freshman student. And today, now the next task is to talk about the nanotoxicology, and especially how the FDA regulates those kind of nanomaterials. Peter, nanomaterial is very hard at Purdue. So I think we have a lot of the faculties coming from some other department looking forward to your talk.
The pressure's on.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Peter. Thank you.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here, and I appreciate the invitation to share with you a little bit about FDA's perspective. As I say that, I think to myself, well, I probably shouldn't say that I'm sharing FDA's perspective. FDA is so large and has multiple centers, and each center has different classes of products, and those products have common issues of concern. They also have unique issues of concern just based on whether it's a drug-like therapy or whether it's an implant with a nano surface on it or nano coating on it. What I first want to do is talk to you a little bit about nano technology perspectives at the agency. And then secondly, many of you probably know this because you're working on some of them, just some of the engineered nanomaterials that we're seeing coming to the agency in areas of nanomedicine and consumer products. And then finally, instead of doing what I usually do, the traditional, we have this hypothesis. We did these experiments. Here are the conclusions, kind of a story. I have little vignettes of what I call issues in nanotoxicology and safety assessment that we're seeing. And it's not only us, but people outside the agency are looking at these issues as well. Just to give you kind of a sense of some of the issues that we're confronting when we see products come in, and issues that we're confronting as we're trying to develop regulations and guidelines for sponsors of products to be aware of as well. We have spent a considerable amount of time at FDA trying to come up with a definition of nanotechnology. And multiple definitions are already out there. And most definitions focus on size between 1 and 100 nanometers, but some go higher than that. The National Nanotechnology Initiative, as most of you know, 8 years ago came up with a definition that's used primarily in a lot of presentations that you see. Nanotechnology is the understanding and control of matter at dimensions of roughly 1 to 100 nanometers in one dimension, and also where unique phenomena or properties enable novel applications. I want to let you know that currently there is no official FDA definition for nanotechnology, but we're certainly seeing products starting to come in from manufacturers. As I mentioned to you, different centers at FDA are working on nano definitions, and we've had long discussions over, it's like we're negotiating a treaty, long discussions over a few sentences. So for the time being, each center has been given the latitude to develop its own, there's a clock. I want to take my watch off. Been given the latitude to develop their own definition. So at the Center for Devices and Radiological Health, we've come up with the working definition or draft definition recently this past summer. Nanotechnology represents a particle or a structure with a submicron size, less than 1,000 nanometers, in any one dimension that demonstrates different physical, chemical, or biological properties as compared to their bulk or larger counterpart. Why did we come up with this definition? Well, in some cases, it was for the reason that it eliminates the bright line of 1 to 100. In the case that we were foreseeing that a 150 nanometer particle could behave in the same way as a 90 nanometer particle. But a company could come to us with an application and say, my product falls out of the range of your nano definition. Therefore, I don't have to do the extra special testing that you require for that product. So we're trying to avoid that kind of debate. And secondly, particles are structures that are larger than 100 nanometer, like this 100 nanometer theoretical particle, may behave differently, just like the 90 nanometer particle of the same material compared to the bulk form of that material. And finally, we are developing guidances. They're not regulations. Regulations take a very long time to get approved, so FDA falls back on guidances, which still take a long time to get approved, but don't quite meet the bar of a regulation or a threshold, so that we can apply them to materials that we know will come in that are above the 100 nanometer range. Well, what kind of products are we seeing at FDA at the moment and that we feel that are going to be coming in around the corner? We've already seen materials like bone and dental fillers, and I think they have nano pores, nano-sized pores in them for better integration of bone structure to make a more solid connection with tissue. We're seeing image contrast agents come in for MRI and ultrasound use. There are diagnostic kits that are being that use nano components in them. FDA approves in vitro diagnostic kits. Some of these are for rapid microbial identification, biosensors, detection of cancer, metastases. Nanosurfaces are an emerging area. Most of the efforts in the past have been on nanomaterials, nanoparticles, nanorods, nanotubes. We actually, in the Center for Devices, anticipate products coming in that may be bulk, three-dimensional, two-dimensional wafers, chips, implants that will have nano features on them, such as nano grooves. These may be applicable for tissue engineering and scaffolds for cell growth in regeneration. You know about titanium dioxide and sunscreens. Nano silver has antimicrobial properties, and we're finding those on wound dressings, band-aids, and as antimicrobial coatings on intravenous catheters, even the ones for coronary artery surgery, stenting. You've probably seen this before, and I know many of you in the room are working on very sophisticated applications for R&D for nanoparticles and potential nanotherapies, and you just know the whole range of colloids and shells and tubes and rods et cetera, and fullerenes. I had a very fruitful discussion with Dr. Alex Wei in chemistry today. He's working on some fascinating aspects here with gold nanorods, and that many coatings and chemistries, surface topographies, changes can be manipulated to target certain tissues or perform certain functions. So there's a significant public health impact on the horizon with the rapid explosion in the uses of nanomaterials and nanostructures for patients and consumers. We're going to see a lot of increase in the use of nanomedicine and consumer products. And to date, in my opinion, most of the efforts and the funding has been designated for R&D innovations, which is good, but more efforts, I believe, are needed to understand the risks to human and environmental health. So what's the impact of nanotechnology on the FDA review process? Product review is probably the major function of the agency. And to date, product review is driven by the intended use of the device or drug. The claims that a company makes for the intended use will determine the type of review and the types of studies that are necessary for the pre-market and clinical review of that product. For example, something as seemingly innocuous as a wound dressing, there are a certain number of studies that are required based on the fact that it has a skin contact and it might be for a short duration. So there are a certain number of studies. However, if there's an implant that's going to be implanted for years, there are additional studies that must be performed because the length of exposure is going to be longer. Just one example of how intended use drives the type of review and the types of study that are necessary. So the process is often independent of the technology, or in the case of diagnostics, the assay format. So the question is being asked around the agency and beyond, does this policy hold true for nanotechnology? And is this a new technology, and does it involve new types of safety concerns? And we're beginning to understand that behavior of materials at the nanoscale can affect a variety of parameters, including the performance, the quality of the product, the quality control issues, safety, and effectiveness. What are some of the safety concerns for medical products that contain engineered nanomaterials? What are the effects of routes of exposure, different routes of exposure that drive different cellular targets, reaching or biodistribution issues, and adverse effects to those targets? Are there differences in toxicokinetics due to the size and surface chemistries of the material? As we all know, nanotechnology in general presents a higher exposure to the material per unit mass, and therefore biological effects might increase in proportion to the dramatically increase in proportion to the total surface area for that unit mass. Gary.
Yeah. A lot of people here are interested in, like, inhalation of nanoparticles. And you're smiling already because you know this is a problem as to what you study and how you study it. So what the exposure really is, when you say higher exposure per unit mass, that's if you calculate that way. But if everything glomps together, then it's less of a problem.
That's true. And I will get into, first of all, at FDA, we don't have too much one of the challenges that we confront is that most of the safety studies, toxicology studies, have been done on inhalation. And that may be the least relevant, clinically relevant route of exposure for products that FDA sees, unless it's some inhaler kind of product. So we're looking for studies and that deal with clinically relevant routes of exposures, subcutaneous, intravenous, oral kinds of exposures. And you're right. Another issue that I want to talk about is that you can characterize the heck out of a particle on the benchtop, but as soon as it hits biological fluids like serum or tissue, it can aggregate and agglomerate, and that large surface area per unit mass will be smaller. So it's a starting point, I think, something to be aware of. But you're right, there are caveats, such as when agglomeration occurs. In some cases, we don't, there haven't been many studies on biodistribution. Where do these things go? We want to use them for therapies. We want to inject them nanogold intravenously for tumor therapy. Well, where does it end up in the body? And finally, what can we learn about metabolism or clearance of these materials? So I still contend that in terms of safety evaluation of nanomaterials, at least for products that are coming to FDA, what we don't know outweighs what we do know. And there are just so many issues that are involved. Gary, you alluded to one regarding characterization and metrology, agglomeration and aggregation issues. We can understand that completely on the benchtop, but what happens when it meets the bloodstream or a dish with cell culture media in it? ADME studies, absorption, tissue distribution, excretion, are important issues where we don't have much information. And what detection methods are available to understand that biodistribution? Often if you label a nanomaterial, it changes the surface, changes the size. Another issue is, what dose metric do we use? People have been using concentration, micrograms per mil, micrograms per kilogram. Is surface area the most appropriate dose metric, or is number of particles injected more appropriate? How do these things get across membranes? Some of you may be working on that aspect. Finally, are the existing battery of safety tests that FDA requires adequate for the evaluation of nanomaterials? So far, I don't think we have evidence that they are not, but there hasn't been a lot of work done on it. And finally, there is evidence both in our lab and other labs that certain nanomaterials can interfere with the assay itself and may give you false positive results.
With all these unknowns, I guess products are still getting approved, right? And
yeah, they are. Again, they are following the guidelines, and nothing, nothing untoward, red flags have come up in our evaluation of them. Some of these products have been on the market a long time, like colloid-type materials. I can't name a specific product, but FDA has been dealing with them for a long time. I think it's just that we're going to see more and different kinds in the future.
I have a question.
Yes.
So, FDA, your work is over, but I understand it has all kinds of procedures for when a new drug is proposed, in terms of certain kinds of animal studies need to be done, and there's phase one and phase two and all this stuff. Is there a reason why that system doesn't just apply to these materials? Is there something unique about these materials that requires a different system or a different set of protocols?
Now, I don't think anyone can answer that definitively. as I said, we don't have any evidence that the existing protocols are inadequate. I think the materials are different enough that it raises some more evaluation, and we just don't have the answers at this point. Tracking where they go in the body, how long they stay there.
So the standard measurements that you like to have are more difficult to attain than these.
Yeah. Anything else, or?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, you could say the same for any new class of materials. You could say, well, are the protocols, the existing protocols, are they sufficient? And I'm just trying to see what's special about this class of materials.
Just,
you've identified, so I think, a little bit about that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can raise it again at the end. We'll see where we are. I want to go now into several little vignettes that I've pulled out of our studies and other studies and try to highlight some of these issues that we think need addressing for safety evaluations. First of all, something that you're probably, most of you are aware of, issue of dispersion of, and Gary was alluding to, of engineered nanomaterials in the biological test system. The hazard assessment depends on an understanding of the properties, the size, the surface charge, the surface chemistries, coatings. Which of these properties drive the biological responses, the therapeutic ones and the potential adverse responses? And you know that properties of these materials can change dramatically depending on what the media they're in, whether it's water versus serum, water versus cell culture media. So what's actually seen by the target tissue when these things go into biological systems? And there are several types of aggregation potential, aggregation, agglomeration, and coagulation of materials. Some of the factors that influence these are the surface chemistries and capping agents, particle-particle interactions, particle-matrix interactions. So we were doing one of our first in vivo studies with nanotitanium. And we asked ourselves, should it came in water and citrate, I think. So we diluted it into distilled water and did a dynamic light scattering measurement of hydrodynamic diameter and found that the average diameter was about 120 nanometers and was not really dependent on the concentration. This also highlights the point that don't believe what the manufacturer tells you their size is, because the manufacturer told us these were 25 nanometer particles, and with the DLS and the electron microscope evaluation, they were over 100 nanometers in diameter. So we looked at other potential injection vehicles, sodium chloride and phosphate buffered saline, and with the sodium chloride alone, the 120 nanometer average diameter was maintained and concentration didn't have an effect. However, when we put it in phosphate buffered saline, which is a really common vehicle for injecting drugs in animal studies and cell culture experiments, we found that almost instantly there was aggregation or agglomeration, and it was dependent on dilution of the material. And we got diameters, hydrodynamic diameters of over 2 microns at concentrated dispersions and over 1 micron at relatively dilute dispersions. So it really is incumbent on the investigator doing biology experiments to understand what happens dependent on the injection vehicle that you use and also what happens in whether you're putting it into the bloodstream or cell culture media. We did an in vitro experiment with the National Institute of Standards and Technology standard reference material, nano gold particles. They were 60 nanometers in diameter. They did very extensive characterization of them. And we wanted to put them in cultured macrophages. And so we played around with whether we should dilute them into water, sodium chloride, physiological saline, the cell culture media, and the cell culture media plus a 10% serum, which is really common for use in cell culture. And the NIST said they were 60 nanometers, and that held true when they were in deionized water. When we put them in physiological saline, the hydrodynamic diameter changed. There appeared to be some aggregation or agglomeration, and that changed with time as well. The standard culture media that we use is RPMI 1640, and that really increased the hydrodynamic diameter of the population of nanogold that we were looking at, and also had a time effect. Now, the standard media that we use is RPMI 1640 plus 10% serum, and lo and behold, that made a dramatic difference in the agglomeration capability, and we got average diameters of less than 100. So again, it's really, one has to be really careful about using these materials once you put them into biological systems. So, and I just made this point, in order to make conclusions about which properties drive biological responses, we have to know what in our system, our biological system, can affect size and other properties. A second issue, in vivo studies. In general, if you look over the literature, there are fewer in vivo studies than in vitro studies that address nanomaterial toxicity. And of the in vivo studies, few address toxicokinetics, the ADME regime, absorption, tissue disposition, metabolism, and excretion. Even fewer ADME and toxicity data are available for nanomaterial exposures, such as subcutaneous or intravenous routes of exposure that are more relevant to medical devices and therapeutics. Most of the studies have used other routes of exposure, and there have been a lot of them by inhalation, the Oberdorfer lab in Rochester and DuPont, skin penetration studies of like for titanium dioxide, nanotitanium used in sunscreens have been done at NCTR, one of our sister centers in the agency, and at NC State and Rice Universities. Again, among the in vivo studies, there have been very few that have been evaluated nanoparticle exposure in pregnant animals, and this has a public health impact for women receiving nano-based therapies during pregnancy. So we designed one of the first studies looking at disposition of nano-silver, again, which is used in regulated products like wound dressings and coatings for catheters. And if there is any kind of release of those materials, where do they go in the body? Is there transfer across the placenta to reach the embryos? And are there adverse effects in the embryos? We synthesized the bare nanoparticles in our with our chemistry colleagues. They were 50 nanometers in diameter, characterized by several methods. We injected them intravenously into pregnant mice on gestation days 7, 8, and 9. These are the most critical times of organogenesis in mouse embryos. And on the next day, gestation day 10, we harvested the tissues, quantitated the silver in the tissues using ICP mass spec. You can see the host of tissues that were analyzed, both in the moms and those that were related to the embryos, such as the myometrium, endometrium in the uterus, and the placentas, the yolk sacs, and the embryos. And this is just briefly our methods. We would inject the mice through the tail vein, and then on gestation day 7, 8, and 9, at day of necropsy, we remove the uterus, which is like a long string of pearls. Each mouse may have 10 or 15 uteri with it. Embryos in the uterus. And we would, under a dissecting scope, would remove the myometrium and endometrium. We had developmental biologists from George Washington University that were very adept at this. And once you remove the myometrium and endometrium, you have the visceral yolk sac surrounding the embryo. That yolk sac was teased away. The placenta associated with each embryo was teased away, and then you end up with the embryo. All these five materials here were pooled for each mouse litter because the amounts were so small. And as we looked at the ICP mass spec data, you can certainly tell which mice were injected with nanosilver and which ones were not. We injected the citrate buffer as the control vehicle. You can see there's a marked distribution of silver to the liver and spleen and a number of the other maternal tissues. And interestingly, there's a large accumulation in the visceral yolk sac compared to control and the other tissues, and not so much, didn't look like a lot got across the placental barrier and reached the embryo. We had an issue when we first looked at this data. We tried to do a mouse balance. We knew how much we injected into each mouse, and then we added up the totals from all the tissues, and we could only account for 50% of the material. So we started collecting urine, and we didn't do it in metabolism cages for the duration of the exposure. We just did a bladder puncture at necropsy, so that was like a spot sample. We didn't collect feces, but we had read reports in the literature that a few studies of disposition of nanomaterials, there was this, the mass balance wasn't working out. They collected most of the tissues. Where was it going? So the hypothesis is that it was just kind of getting in interstitial spaces within the carcass. So we did the old fashioned 1960s, 50s style. We just took all the tissues out and ground up the carcass in a blender and did the ICP mass spec for silver. And we also took the tail, the site of injection, and some material was accumulated, and ground that up too and digested it. And it was there was enough accumulated there at the site of injection. So that got us really close. I want to share the rest of the story a little later. But when we did it, this is milligrams per nanograms of silver per milligram tissue, and here is a percent of the dose. And you can see that ultimately we recovered on average about 98% of the respective dose. And again, most of it's in the liver and spleen and tail and carcass, with very little going to the embryo. There was an issue with nanosilver as to whether it dissolves slowly in vivo. And we synthesized these materials ourselves, so we weren't quite sure of the stability of them. And someone asked, well, how do you know if you're with the ICP mass spec? Are you measuring nanoparticle silver, or are you measuring dissolved silver from the nanoparticles? So we injected silver nitrate, which was the starting material to synthesize the nanosilver, and we injected the equivalent amount of silver in each mouse. And you can see that there's quite a different response, that most of the silver that we're seeing in the liver, for example, was due to nanosilver, and very little soluble silver got to the liver. And that trend was apparent through most of the tissues. Yeah.
So you said you injected an equivalent amount, but it looks like there's much less of the NGL3 than is
in. You took.
So why would they be equivalent amounts?
Well, we know we injected equivalent amounts. Your question is where's the soluble silver?
Yeah.
Well, you stole one of my conclusions. We're just hypothesizing that the excretion of the soluble silver could have been much greater over that 24-hour period. And we didn't collect, we only collect spot urines at the end. That's just like 30 microliters of urine in the bladder, something like that. So it's not a good, we don't collect feces.
You don't collect skin.
I don't think we did for this soluble silver study. So we did for the, when we were just doing nano silver, we did carcass and tail. But
I think about Argentia, I think about skin.
Yeah.
And would you say there's a difference, I mean, aside from the fact that you have all this exhaust and excretion that doesn't show up to it, just in terms of the relative distribution of the tissues, would you say the nanoparticles behave differently in terms of how they distribute versus society?
Well, you may have a point there.
I'm asking, I don't know how it reads in other bottles.
It does appear in, I haven't quite, didn't think about that much before, but it does appear that for both of the types of materials that you get a higher accumulation in liver and spleen, and in the yolk sac seems to be a sink for it.
But that's a typical distribution of a nanoparticle. They all
yeah.
Liver, spleen, lung. So that's why therapy is not as effective because they all go to the three places, not to the tumor.
Mm-hmm. Places. Yeah, thanks for the second part of your point. Your first part, I don't have to show my next slide. I don't think you guys have got it all figured out. Well, it'll come up soon. Any more questions about this study? I want
to
move.
Just a follow-up to what he said.
Yeah.
So the story is that the liver and the spleen are...
they're typically...
capturing these particles or scavenging them or somehow...
They're part of the reticuloendothelial system, which scavenges material like that, particulate materials. So it's not surprising that we see particles collecting in liver, a spleen, lymph node.
Is that just true of particles in general?
And yes.
So not specifically nanoparticles.
That's correct.
When you talk about the silver nanoparticles, you're talking about the silver zero, right? And when you talk about silver nitrate, you are talking about silver cation that's mm-hmm. positively charged.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with completely different chemicals. There is no, no surprising. They have completely different things. For silver zero, that one inside any biological system, I assume they will remain inert, go to, as Dr. Park is saying, go to liver, lung, spleen, that's the normal routine. But if you go through a silver nitrate, it's monocationic species. I'm surprised they still stay inside the body for that long. They probably go to the urine or somewhere else.
Yep, you have a good point. The only thing I will offer is that the antimicrobial mechanism of nano silver is believed to be the slow dissolution of monovalent silver from the particle in a very slow way. That's in part why we wondered if the particles we made weren't of high quality, and they were maybe dissolving at a more rapid rate. So they are two different silver zero and monoatomic silver are different chemistries, but it's believed that there is a slow dissolution of monovalent silver from nano silver, which is zero valence.
They better show the evidence.
There are a lot of people working on it.
Because silver itself is very, very inert in mm-hmm. a lot of sense, just like gold.
I think you're right. Silver has to become ionized to be effective. So it has to be equilibrated.
So it's and silver is very effective against microbes, and it's the the ion. Yeah. So, yes. So
what do the silver nanoparticles accumulating in the orbits do?
We don't know that. We collected these tissues for histopathology, and we haven't done a careful analysis of those. We didn't see anything grossly that looked apparent. The developmental biologist evaluated each embryo. There's a hand of 10 or 15 things that they can see in an embryo. If we look at that, I mean, you can look at this and, you know, do some evaluations with heart size and head size and something with the somites that'll become the skeleton back here. They didn't see anything at this gross morphology level there. So I don't have a good answer for that. We haven't evaluated it. I'm not aware of any study showing nanosilver histopathologic changes. Or biochemical changes, for that matter. We need to leave at 20 after? Okay. We also did a study with titanium nanoparticles. It was kind of the first venture. We tried to understand what we were injecting, which I shared with you before. This is just a tool that we're using looking at electron microscopy and showing these electron-dense materials in the liver Kupffer cell, which is the macrophage. You don't know if that's nanomaterial or not. So when we use the electron dispersive X-ray spectroscopy that some colleagues provided for us, we mapped titanium and oxygen to the same pattern as that electron-dense material. This was in mice 6 months after the sub-Q injection, so there is a long residence time. And again, the highest levels, we've talked about the filtering capacity. That's why we see it in liver and spleen. We found out from the literature that the visceral yolk sac has a high endocytotic capacity, and it also has high-affinity mercury-binding proteins, metallothionines, in it. And we didn't see any morphological changes. So I want to keep moving. I just want to again highlight that, you know, these materials can have a long residence time in the body, and I just don't think we have enough information as to whether that's significant or not. But an FDA reviewer may ask you that question. In fact, ADME is almost always asked for in any kind of drug product that goes before the Center for Devices. And I just want to keep moving here. Just some things we found out about mass balance with the carcass, which is old-fashioned toxicology, but maybe of some value here. We also do in vitro studies, and there are a lot of issues here. There are standards for testing of particles that were written by our group for micron-sized particles, concerns about wear debris coming off of orthopedic implants. And just recently, metal-on-metal orthopedic implants have hit the news again, and there is wear debris from the continued cup and ball joint, and that can cause significant inflammatory reactions in some patients. So we've developed standards for looking at inflammatory potential of micron materials in macrophages. We want to know if they're appropriate for nanomaterials. And we did this, had a student who did a tremendous amount of characterization of silicon nanoparticles that he synthesized at NIST. He was a University of Maryland graduate student. And he did some characterization of the material. And we looked for cellular uptake in the macrophages of the 3-nanometer silicon. And they naturally fluoresce red. And so under fluorescence, you can see the material. And then when the computer overlays, you can see that there's some evidence of cell uptake. So this is a good tool for that. With the time, there are just some issues here. Are these cytotoxicity and inflammatory in vitro assays appropriate for nanomaterials? And I think in general they are, but we've just found some interesting differences with this study that allowed us to make some recommendations for others to consider. First of all, we compared nano and micron, which I think is important to do. We also used more than one cytotoxicity assay that operate by different mechanisms. And you can see that the nanoparticles were, this assay, the MTT assay, a standard cytotox assay was much more sensitive to nanosilicon than the TriPan Blue assay, a much higher response in cell killing here at 50. And we saw that the nanoparticles were cytotoxic at lower concentrations compared to the micron size materials. So there are differences in assays, responses this way, and there are differences in material effects, be they nano or micron, of the same material. I don't think I have time for this. So we saw, as I said, differences in responses. We're recommending that sponsors use more than one method to assess the same endpoint. For example, cytotoxicity, use one that measures membrane damage and one that measures mitochondrial metabolism damage. Because if you just rely on one, you can get drastic different interpretations of the potential toxicity of your particle. Again, a bonus recommendation. This is one that many people outside of FDA do not appreciate the need for until it's explained to them. Medical devices have to pass a sterility and endotoxin test. Endotoxin is the leftover product of pathogens, dead pathogen cell membranes, lipopolysaccharide. This material has a high inflammatory potential. Every product that's approved by every device that's approved has to meet a minimum level, very low level of endotoxin contamination. You can sterilize a product. That doesn't mean that the endotoxin has been eliminated. So when people prepare nanomaterials or any material, nanomaterials for potential therapies, they're going to have to ensure that they meet the standard of endotoxin contamination before FDA will approve it. Otherwise, you could have some serious inflammatory responses in patients. We did our nano gold study, bare particles, and I just want to show you, some of you may be aware of this in the literature, but it's really important to run no cell controls in your in vitro assays. We have some common cytotoxicity assays here. Nitric oxide is a good inflammatory potential indicator, and I don't know which cytokine this is when the student put it there. But as you can see, in the absence of nanoparticles, no nanoparticles and no cells, we called that response 100%. And without cells in the wells, we just added increasing concentrations of nanogold and ran the assay. So everything was fine, except for the MTT assay, which started showing an increased absorbance just because of the presence of the nanomaterial itself at the same wavelength as the MTT assay is run. So you could have a potential false positive reading here because of the inherent absorbance of that nanomaterial. Yep.
Not thinking of the details, but is it really absorbance or is it just reflecting back? I mean, a cloudy solution is going to give you a similar reading no matter what the wavelength. So I'm trying to figure out whether it's really a absorbance or just...
Don't have a good answer for you. I think other people have seen this and are calling it an absorbance interference. So run a no-cell control, I think, is the gist of this. We just confirmed uptake of nanogold into endosomes in the macrophages with X-ray dispersive analysis. This is a representative graph from the top row, which shows gold spectra, and this one shows osmium spectra in untreated cells in the bottom. Just confirm that the material that you're seeing in imaging is actually material. So this is my last issue related to our pregnant mouse study. Again, we only accounted for 50% of in our mass balance issue. The carcass and tail took us up to 75 or 80. We were still missing some. What happened to it? It could have been excreted because we didn't collect feces. But one of us thought about checking the syringe, what we did the injection with. And so we did an ICP mass spec measurement of our stock dosing solution. And then we pulled an amount up into a syringe that we use for injection and immediately ejected it into a ICP mass spec vessel. And we saw that we recovered less than 50% of the silver as the stock solution. So there was a great amount that was seemed to be binding to the plastic material. And this could have significant impact of reporting dosages for certain effects, not only for in vivo studies, but for cell culture dishes as well, if you're doing in vitro experiments. Just one of those alligators that's out there potentially interfering with conclusions about the studies. So this is just a repeat of the issues that I tried to bring up in the discussion today. And I just have a lot of collaborators, both inside FDA and different universities and collaborators outside of FDA that I need to acknowledge. So thanks a lot for listening and your attention.